Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
And Ken, I think we're both a little sleepy because that speech went on a long time last night, and today just came a little bit early.
I'm not sleepy. I'm just wondering whether he did what he wanted to do. I think President Obama gives a great speech. I think he's thoughtful. I think he lays it all out. But ultimately, it sounds like we've heard this before. It reminds me of the famous Joe Wilson ULI speech from last September, where he also, the president, laid out the case for health care before a joint session of Congress, not a State of the Union address. But the language I heard Wednesday night and last September seems eerily similar.
Yes, but on the other hand, they needed to be eerily similar because the situation is still very much up in the air. The president is still trying to push that particular piece of legislation to its final point. And of course, we can talk about it, as we have talked about, all the problems that it's had since. But he got a bump back in September when he gave that speech. It revived the momentum behind the health care bill at that time, back in September, and helped the House pass it barely, and helped the Senate get it to the point where it actually was getting 60 votes for all the procedural tests in December, and actually got the entire construct of this bill right to the brink of approval until the Democrats lost their 60th vote in Massachusetts. So now here's the president again trying to figure out some way to nudge it over the finish line.
But if the way to nudge it is by saying we can work this out, or let's get together, or give it a second look, to me that was no strategy at all. A lot of people thought, well, maybe he would try to get the House Democrats to vote for the Senate plan, which of course was never going to happen, as Nancy Pelosi said over and over again. But I don't know what changed. I mean, the dynamic around him changed, the political dynamic changed. He doesn't have the numbers he once had, and his numbers are below 50%. Not that we should be focused on the numbers. I mean, that's not the
key. No, but obviously that's a measure of something real, some change in people's attitude.
Bill Clinton's first State of the Union address, he had a 60% job approval ratings, and then, you know, months later, the Democrats lost both the House and Senate.
And we should point out that Ronald Reagan, when he gave his first true State of the
Union
speech,
January
1982, it was exactly the same, 49% in the Gallup, and Barack Obama 49% in the NPR poll that was just released. And there were a lot of different expectations and a lot of different burdens on the president in giving this particular speech. There was the idea of getting more conciliatory with the minority, since the minority is voting so effectively.
The minority is meaning the Republicans.
That's right. There was also the impetus to move the Democrats back into a position of sympathy with the populist rage in the country against
the
bad economy.
And he started his speech that way. He talked about anxieties and the anxiety that's out there for families. And I kind of thought he would be using more Tea Party rhetoric, which has been effective for the Tea Party movement. And yet then he went into the politics of blame and the politics of we've heard this before.
And two or three pages of boilerplate about how important it is to have trade and how important it is to have education. All important things, but the sort of thing you usually hear in the laundry list of a State of the Union. And it seemed to me took away from the momentum of the points that he was trying to make. But here's a little bit of what he had to say as he scolded and almost lectured both of the two parties about their performance in Congress.
The Democrats, I would remind you that we still have the largest majority in decades, and the people expect us to solve problems, not run for the hills.
Run for the hills. Okay.
Does that mean Byron Dorgan type running for the hills? No.
Well, to some degree, I think it does. I think it addresses a number of Democrats who are suddenly less enthusiastic about running either for re-election or as a challenge to a Republican incumbent in 2010. There is a sense among the Democrats in both chambers, even before the Massachusetts result, and it's really gotten pell-mell since Massachusetts, that they suddenly need to be in some kind of full retreat because they've had a couple of reversals and because they've seen some polls that don't look so good.
Well, so as the expectation game was being played prior to the State of the Union and wondering what kind of reach out, if any, there was going to be from the president to the Republicans, the other question was how he was going to deal with his fellow Democrats, which are far from united on the issue of such as health care. The progressive wing has always said, enough of the negotiating, let's just do the reconciliation, let's just ram it through.
With a simple majority.
51 votes and not worry about 59 or 60 or so. And then the centrist who say, look, what got us in this mess to begin with is that the American people thought we were moving too fast, and perhaps maybe tone it down a little bit, either make it more palatable for the Republicans or not as expansive as it had been.
So in the absence of perfect unity among Democrats, the perfect unity among Republicans is really quite potent, especially because of that rule in the Senate that says if you're going to bring anything important to the floor to talk about it, you have to get 3/5 of the Senate to agree to do so, a supermajority. And the president talked about that, too.
And if the Republican leadership is going to insist that 60 votes in the Senate are required to do any business at all in this town, a supermajority, then the responsibility to govern is now yours as well. Just saying no to everything may be good short-term politics, but it's not leadership. We were sent here to serve our citizens, not our ambitions.
It's kind of naive to say that, wow, this was a political speech, because anything, and by definition, anything said in Washington is political.
But certainly by the president.
But I thought this was a more political State of the Union speech than I expected. It almost seems like there was no lesson learned in New Jersey or Virginia or now Massachusetts. If anything, I wasn't communicating well enough. There was nothing wrong with what I was saying. I just didn't do it clearly enough. Let me say it to you even more clearly than I have been. And I thought basically he was rubbing the Republicans' nose in it. I mean, there are some Republicans who, of course, will always get upset every time he mentions that he inherited a mess, and he did inherit a mess, and it's ludicrous to suggest otherwise. But it just seemed like for all his shying away from wanting to play the blame game, he seemed to be playing more blame game in a political State of the Union speech than I would have expected.
Well, it's more of the attempt on his part to balance the necessity to reach out for some kind of Republican cooperation on the one hand, and also to communicate to his own team that he is still in some sense or another their team leader.
Did you hear him reaching out at all? I didn't hear any reach out.
There was an attempt on his part on several occasions to take some of the blame for things not working very well, but he did not say, for example, I could take a Republican proposal on selling insurance across state lines, or let's go a little further in accepting your ideas on tort reform, or something of that nature. He did do that in September. He didn't do that last night, I suspect, because those very negotiations are going on right now, and he did not want the speech to interfere with those negotiations. He was trying to change the political atmosphere in those two rather contradictory ways, and while I thought he did a creditable job of attempting to serve those two masters, it's very difficult to, in some sense or another, reconcile those two impulses.
And for all the discussion about bipartisanship and reaching out, even in the instances where there seemed to be some kind of an effort by the president to say something that the Republicans would be happy about, like, here are all the tax cuts I've made, and he went off the whole
litany. Or Afghanistan, for example, where Republicans support him more than Democrats.
And yet, when you look at the pictures of John Boehner and all the Republicans sitting there, just either with their arms crossed.
McConnell looked embalmed. Yeah, yeah. He literally just was so motionless and so emotionless. And, you know, I think partly what we're dealing with here is the moment in history that is not entirely of Barack Obama's creation. It's something that he was pleased to use as a candidate when he was running against all the foils that he had to run against. He could run against the presidency of George W. Bush, run against the Republican Party's excesses in the last decade. He could run against Hillary Clinton and the sort of perception of her as a highly partisan figure. He could be the guy who was positioned against all of that, and I think that's why a lot of independents liked him in 2008. And then he gets the job of being totally the leader of one team, but all that serves to accomplish in the end is, one, it alienates the independents who are seeing something different in him. And then number two, it alienates the most partisan Democrats, the most ideological liberals, who wanted something much more successful in that first year, or at least in the first 2 years.
I think the thing that surprised me the most of the speech was not so much that he had an opinion on the ruling regarding corporate spending in campaigns, but the fact that he would use the venue of a State of the Union address to basically admonish the Supreme Court.
Scolding.
He absolutely did. And there were some people said, right on, that's exactly what you should do. It's a bad decision and all that. I was just thinking back to Dwight Eisenhower, who in his memoirs said that Earl Warren, the choice of Earl Warren, was the worst mistake he ever made as president. The thought of President Eisenhower in a State of the Union address criticizing a Supreme Court decision. Look, it's one thing for the president to say in a press conference, I disagree with the court on this, but just to sit there, to stand there before a nationwide audience and the Supreme Court sitting right in front of him saying that I think you just blew it. It just seemed off-putting to me.
Yes, there was a change from tradition in that, and that will probably cost him among some people who have a more traditional view of what a presidential role ought to be, particularly in a ceremonial occasion. But this is also a highly politicized moment, and it can be argued that it was highly politicized by the actions of some of the people in that room, not least among them the Supreme Court, who did make an extraordinary political decision in 2000 when they decided the presidential election, and who did make an extraordinary political decision this past week when they decided in Citizens United that corporations have all the same rights that people do. That is an amazing reversal of many decades of the direction of the court. And Sandra Day O'Connor, who wrote the last opinion on this subject just 7 years ago, denounced the court herself quite publicly this very week, on camera, no questions asked. She went after them on it in exactly the same way that the president did last night. So when you say that somebody has broken the old rules, it might not be just the president.
Big news of the week seems to be a Watergate Redux kind of story in New Orleans when four people were arrested inside of Mary Landrieu's Senate office. What's that about?
Well, you know, on one level, I want to say we're going from the tremendously important, sublime, if you will, of American politics, a State of the Union, the Supreme Court, all the most important issues, to something that is ridiculous, something that is really just a side, you know, minor story. A few people who tried to pull some kind of a stunt, and I think most of us are thinking that they were not in there to fix the copier, that they were messing with the phones. And they were being, in some sense or another, associated with a man who previously has taken cameras into Acorn headquarters and badly embarrassed that organization by showing bad misbehavior within that organization.
Bad misbehavior. That's the worst kind of misbehavior.
Well, but I mean, people really seriously advising people on, you know, how to hide money from taxation and how to get away with crime.
Prostitution, right.
And this, those tapes were devastating for Acorn. Acorn was cut out of all kinds of federal spending.
Right.
It's now radioactive. They weren't allowed to help with census gathering. And they were devastated by that. And this same individual has now been arrested inside a United States senator's office down in New Orleans, a home office for Mary Landrieu, apparently in some way associated with some other people who were in there acting like they had an official task to perform for the phone company to fix her telephones. A lot of people think that this has a wiretapping implication.
James O'Keefe is the gentleman who posed as a pimp when he went into the Acorn offices, and now he was already in Landrieu's office recording all these so-called phone company people who want to fix the phone system. The best part about this story is that, first of all, for the longest time, the left really ignored the Acorn story. They said it's really not a big story, you know, even though the embarrassment when O'Keefe...
You're talking about the very first few days.
Right, when O'Keefe goes into the... And now it's the right who says, well, you know, we don't know what O'Keefe was doing. I mean, they're actually kind of trying to...
Could be a misunderstanding.
...bury that story as well. It's just...
Although they have also said that if this was wiretapping, that is wrong, and people should not be wiretapping United States senators in an attempt to capture them in some sort of perfidy.
First of all, that's a federal offense, wiretapping.
And, it is a 10-year.
Yes, and that has
in
not
the federal been, prison type
and
offense.
The four gentlemen who have been arrested have not been charged with wiretapping as of yet.
And the odds are they won't be, and the odds are they won't be going to jail at all.
I think Ron Ziegler would call it a third-rate phone tampering. You know that next week, by the way, starts the 2010 primary season, and it begins in Illinois.
Now you're talking about something serious again. Now you're back to the real stuff. Ken, this is what the listener wants to hear.
That's right. Tuesday, February 2nd.
Wow, that's awfully early, isn't it?
It's early for us. It just seemed to come out of nowhere. And yet, now that we're talking about Illinois, a lot of people are saying, well, you know how blue Massachusetts is. Perhaps Illinois has a chance for Republican pickup. Mark Kirk, the 5-term moderate Republican congressman, seems to have maybe an advantage now with a divided Democratic field to replace the Honorable Roland Burris.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, Mark Kirk has actually been taken as a pretty serious candidate for this seat long before Massachusetts blew up on everybody's landscape. And even really before the November wins in the gubernatorial contests, Mark Kirk just looked like a stronger candidate than anybody that the Democrats had that was in position to run. Except the state attorney general, Lisa Madigan, who decided that she didn't want to run.
The front runner for the Democratic primary is the state treasurer, Alexei Janulius, who may or may not have ties, or at least his family's banking business has ties, to Tony Rezko. And I think this is one of the issues that Republicans would love to run against. And the Democrats really know this after Rod Blagojevich. The question is whether the Democrats want to put themselves in a vulnerable position with a questionable nominee. And there's a guy named David Hoffman, who's a first-time candidate, who's been endorsed by the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times. There's also Cheryl Jackson, a former NPR communications person, I should mention, so like a decade or so, who left her job from the Chicago Urban League to run. She is one of two major African-American candidates running for the Senate this year. The other one is in New York.
And the other one is Harold Ford, who is not what everyone thinks of as a native New Yorker.
No, unlike Hillary Clinton or Bobby Kennedy.
I realize that I keep bringing this up, but Harold Ford is moving from Tennessee Right. He has not been a household name in New York as some of these other people who ran from other states, Bobby Kennedy, Hillary Clinton, clearly were.
Right.
And he is running why, Ken?
And that's a very good question. The reason is, of course, he misses the limelight. He wants to be part of it. He thinks New York is a great venue. But, of course, he's by running...
Venue or, shall we say, vacancy?
Well, there's an opportunity in New York because there's an unelected...
Appointed.
Democratic incumbent.
Who replaced Hillary Clinton.
Right, who was appointed by an unelected Democratic governor, David Paterson.
And her name is Kirsten Gillibrand.
And her name is Kirsten Gillibrand, who has been criticized by Harold Ford. In an interview last week, Harold Ford Jr. Described Kirsten Gillibrand as a parakeet unwilling to stand up to the Democratic bosses.
And what did she have to say about that? Easy for her to say. I wonder if she could repeat that.
You know who resented that? Senator Robert Byrd. He was very upset about that. Got very angry. But and her response was that Harold Ford is selling himself as an outsider. Meanwhile, he waltzed, Gillibrand's words, he waltzed into his father's congressional seat in 1996.
In Memphis, Tennessee.
Held it for 10 years until he ran for the Senate. Then he waltzed into the Democratic Leadership Council, which is the ultimate insider organization in Washington, according to Gillibrand.
Yeah, according to Gillibrand.
So this is nasty. Harold Ford Jr. has not announced his candidacy yet, but for all the times we're talking about these ugly Republican primaries, Charlie Crist and Rubio.
Charlie Crist is apparently behind Marco Rubio.
That's what it looks like.
Latest polls.
And, of course, Hutchinson and Perry in Texas.
Not to mention J.D. Hayworth running against John McCain in Arizona. Yeah. There's a stunner. And those are going to be nasty.
They are nasty. But to point out, there are Democrats also who have their own nasty internal mess that they have to deal with.
Here's an interesting question to me, though. Aren't the Democrats less ideological in these internal fights? It seems to me that Florida, Texas, and Arizona are all very much ideological. Also in California, where the statewide races are being fought out on a kind of centrist versus conservative basis. This thing in New York just appears to be, I mean, parakeet? I mean, how serious is
this? It's mostly ambition, I think. They're trying to make it ideological because the Gillibrand people are saying Harold Ford is so out of the mainstream. He was pro-gun when he was in Tennessee. He campaigned as a pro-lifer.
In Tennessee.
And of course, the people who don't like Kirsten Gillibrand saying, wait a second, this was a pro-gun, fairly moderate conservative.
Gillibrand
in upstate New York, who suddenly became far more moderate, far more liberal.
Yeah, but if she's going to have an alternative, if there's going to be another candidate in the New York Democratic primary for the Senate, does it need to be somebody to the right? Yeah,
that's what nobody expected.
Of Kirsten Gillibrand.
And you know who this benefits? Bruce Blakeman.
Oh, that's my first thought.
Yeah. Bruce Blakeman, it seems to be the only or the leading Republican candidate. I mean, everybody's saying, well, this is bad news for the Democratic Party. Harold Ford's expected challenge could hurt Gillibrand's control of the seat. But there is no name Republican running in the race. However, I have two words for you, Scott Brown, which is that almost in this political climate, any no-name Republican, if there's a slight opening, could have a chance to go.
I think somebody could even argue that a no-name Republican almost has a better chance of becoming the perfect vehicle for everyone to suddenly say, all right, I don't like the Democrats, I don't like that Democrat, I'm just going to vote for whoever's against them. And the less I know about that person, the less reason I would have to object to that person. And I suddenly see some guy come along who's a blank slate, and I project all my anger onto that person and say, he's my champion.
One famous person who I was convinced was going to run for the Senate who suddenly did not, Beau says no in Delaware.
That is correct. Beau Biden, the son of Vice President Joe Biden and longtime senator, was assumed to be coming back from his duty in Iraq to resume his duties in the state of Delaware as the state attorney general, and then to move into his father's seat. Now, 1 year ago, I think he probably would have had a hard time getting any kind of a bet in Delaware that he wasn't going to do exactly that. Well, he's not even going to try.
Well, he was going to be the appointed successor, and the reason he wasn't because, you say, he went to Iraq.
So he was on duty.
So what they did, they had to force Ted Kaufman, Joe Biden's longtime pal, to be a seat warmer for a year, but it was always until Beau Biden came back from
Iraq.
Right.
That's right. And there was never any intention for Kaufman to run any more than Paul Kirk in Massachusetts. But then one other huge thing happened, not in the category of Scott Brown, but in the category of the one ideal Republican candidate who could have thrown a scare into Beau Biden stepping up and saying, I'd like to be a United States senator, and that's longtime House member, previously governor, Mike Castle.
Right. Mike Castle has run statewide 12 times. He's undefeated.
12 times.
Now, Biden is 40 years old. Castle is 70 years old.
So what would Beau say to himself?
Well, here's what I think is happening. First of all, there are two things. One, Beau Biden has a very strong record against child predators. There's a major case going on in Delaware that the Attorney General's office is working on, and that is to convict this pediatrician who is alleged to have committed horrific crimes against children. So that is the official excuse.
He wants to finish that.
But here's another thing. This is for the end of Joe Biden's term, which ends in 2014. I suspect Mike Castle runs as the Republican, wins, does not run for another term in 2014, and then we revisit the Biden dynasty in 2014.
All right, and that makes a certain amount of sense. Not to say that this is some sort of prearranged deal among all of the principals, but just that people think ahead and people do sort these things out for their own long-term best advantage. No reason for him to sacrifice the arc of his career in a year that's looking increasingly problematic for Democrats in even blue states. And Mike Castle would be a perfect case of somebody who, like Mark Kirk in Illinois, or perhaps somebody in another state, could step into a seat that otherwise they probably wouldn't have even tried to win.
You know, you mentioned Mark Kirk, who's a centrist Republican, moderate Republican. You mentioned Mike Castle. There used to be a time in the old days where there was something called a liberal Republican.
Yes, and his name was Charles McSee Mathias.
Mac Mathias, the three-term senator from Maryland, former three-term senator from Maryland, and former congressman, died this week at the age of 87. He was not even a moderate. He was a liberal Republican.
He was an outright liberal.
Even though he ran, he supported Richard Nixon when he first ran for the Senate in 1968. He voted against Carswell. He voted against Haynesworth, the Supreme Court nominees. He voted against Rehnquist being elevated to the Chief Justice. He voted against the war in Vietnam. He was really a thorn in Republican side, and yet he never was the kind of like Arlen Specter type who would consider switching parties. I mean, he was an
ancestral Republican.
He was, and basically that's a lot of what the Republican Party was back then. They had different wings. They had the conservative wing. They had the moderate wing.
Chafees from Rhode Island.
Right. They had Chafee. They had Javits. They had Percy. They had George Aiken of Vermont. They had people.
Well, they had liberals like Thomas Kuchel from California.
Tom Kuchel. They had Clifford Case in New Jersey. The thing is, they used to be a bunch of so-called liberal Republicans, and yet it's interesting that back then, even with all those wings, they never had a majority in the Senate. All the years that Charles Mathias was in the Senate and Congress, only his last term in the Senate were they in the majority, whereas for most of the last 12 years, with mostly conservatives, there was a Republican majority.
Of course, the difference in those days was that you had 11, 12, 13 states in the South that would regularly send two Democrats.
Never send a Republican. Good
never
point.
Send a Republican. And yet, those Southern Democrats were, if anything, more conservative than the average Republicans, certainly more conservative than the liberal Republicans you're talking about.
And certainly more on race.
And on other things as well, though, on defense spending, on spending in general, they were conservatives. They happened to call themselves Democrats because of the particular history of the South, but they were the most conservative members of the Senate after 1994, and ever since, the majority of the Southern seats have been held by Republicans. And those Republicans are always conservatives, and they're always calling themselves Republicans as well. And that's what's really changed in the United States Congress.
And when you think of civil rights bills, and you think, of course, the Democrats who pushed it through in 1964, Charles Mathias, along with John Lindsay and Bill McCulloch of Ohio, one of the few liberal Republicans in the House who were fighting for civil rights bills even before the 64 bill was enacted.
I remember being on the floor of the Republican convention in Dallas in 1984 when they would not seat the Maryland Republicans who went there, Mac Mathias among them. They didn't want him there. They didn't want somebody who was so far from being a Reagan Republican in their ranks.
And since Charles Mathias retired after 1986, there's not been a Republican elected to the Senate from Maryland.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Those were the days, and you knew where you were then.
Girls were girls and men were men. Mister, we could use a man like Herbert Hoover again. Didn't need no welfare states.
Everybody pulled his weight. G.R. Old Lasso.